Israel, of course, never misses a chance to show off, and Netanyahu has been proudly boasting about how fast he was able to secure so many doses of the vaccine and administer them to his population. And the media has also been singing Israel's praises, citing it as an example of efficiency. The New York Times writing that Israel has become a world leader in vaccinating against COVID-19. And it's true. If you look at the figures, Israel has a higher rate of inoculation than anyone else. The problem is, those numbers are lying. Those numbers do not include the 5 million Palestinians living under Israel's illegal occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. The Guardian first reported on January 3rd, 2021, how Israel transports batches of the Pfizer vaccine deep into the West Bank, but they are only distributed to Jewish settlers and not the roughly 2.7 million Palestinians living around them, who may have to wait for weeks or months. According to the BBC, Palestinians living in East Jerusalem, which is also under illegal occupation, are entitled to be vaccinated as they're considered residents. However, Palestinians living in the West Bank or in Gaza, being illegally occupied by Israel, are not. The only people in those areas that are entitled to be vaccinated are the Zionist settlers who are living there illegally. Israel's military occupation, its Zionist settlements, these are all illegal under international law. There are numerous UN Security Council resolutions clearly, unequivocally stating that Israel must leave and that these settlements are illegal under international law. Matthias Kennis, a medic from Doctors Without Borders who works in the West Bank, also wrote in late February how he was shocked by Israel's cruelty, saying, quote, "You are over 60 times more likely to have a vaccination in Israel than in Palestine." Kennis goes on to say that a few kilometers away in Israel, all the vulnerable groups have been vaccinated, and they are planning to move on to vaccinating healthy adults and youths who are less vulnerable, especially to severe complications. Here in the West Bank, there are around 10,000 doses, which is enough for 5,000 people to be vaccinated. In the hospital where I work, staff have been offered the vaccine, but the available doses do not come close to covering the healthcare workers, let alone the elderly and people with medical conditions that make them susceptible to dying of COVID-19. The United States Senator and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders wrote a joint letter with other senators urging Secretary of State Blinken to pressure Israel to vaccinate Palestinians. In the letter, it states that, quote, "While the Oslo Accords give the Palestinian Authority considerable responsibility for the healthcare of Palestinians, the Accords do not supersede Israel's responsibilities under the Fourth Geneva Convention." And this is absolutely correct. Because you see, this is what the Israelis are trying to argue. They're claiming that they have no legal obligation to vaccinate Palestinians, despite the fact that they're illegally occupying Palestinians. The Israelis claim that under the Oslo Accords of 1995, if you look at Annex 3, Article 17, it says, quote, "Powers and responsibilities in the sphere of health in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip will be transferred to the Palestinian side, including the health insurance system." However, under Article 56 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, it says that, quote, "The occupying power, which is Israel in this case, has the duty of ensuring and maintaining, with the cooperation of national and local authorities, the medical and hospital establishments and services, public health and hygiene in the occupied territory, with particular reference to the adoption and application of the prophylactic and preventative measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics." It's important to note, however, that the Oslo Accords, they were a bilateral agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians. The Geneva Convention is much larger than that, much older than that. It's a pillar of international law. So it's completely irrational and unreasonable to argue that the Oslo Accords somehow cancel out or supersede the Geneva Convention, which Israel and Palestine are both a party to. Also, even if you want to take the Israelis' argument at face value, how can you expect the Palestinians to be in charge of their own health affairs when Israel is occupying them? How are Palestinians expected to run an efficient healthcare system and build public health infrastructure when they are told what they can and can't import, when they are told when and where they can go, when they don't even have a state, when they are living under a brutal Zionist occupation that denies them their basic human rights? And if the occupation wasn't bad enough, every single time Israel viciously bombs Gaza, it purposely targets civilian and public health infrastructure. And while Mr. Erdan, who is Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, claims on Twitter that the Palestinian Authority is responsible for its own health affairs and that Israel will facilitate their purchase of the Sputnik vaccine from Russia. Well, hold on a second. Why would Israel need to facilitate Palestinians' purchase of a vaccine if Palestinians are responsible for their own health affairs? There's a bit of a contradiction there, don't you think? And of course, even that turned out to be a lie. When Gaza tried to import vaccines from Russia, Israel blocked it. A shipment of a mere 1,000 doses, which is barely enough for 500 people, was still blocked by Israel. This is so emblematic of their wicked treatment towards Palestinians. According to Al Jazeera, Israeli lawmakers were even debating whether to let in vaccines out of fear that they would go to Hamas leadership. Well, here's a solution. Why not just give all Palestinian civilians vaccines? Then you won't have to worry about that, right? So Israel even waited 3 months. Since December, they waited 3 months before giving vaccines to the 100,000 plus Palestinians that it uses as cheap labor who cross over into Israel every day. Here's a PR photo that they put out in some depraved attempt to make themselves look like humanitarian occupiers and whitewash their occupation. I mean, it's so dehumanizing. Israel still has millions of vaccines, while millions of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza have none. And like with all criticisms of Zionism, Israel grew furious when people began calling out its racist medical apartheid towards Palestinians. The Guardian was accused of lying and asked to apologize over its articles. Even Michael Che, who joked on Saturday Night Live about Israel only vaccinating its Jewish population, was accused of racism. Netanyahu, along with Danny Dunan and several other Israeli officials, quickly rushed to accuse him of anti-Semitism. So while the Israelis have been able to enjoy an easing of lockdown restrictions and a drop in infections of COVID-19, just earlier this month, on March 11, Palestinians saw their worst day yet with a record 27 fatalities and 2,300 registered cases in a single day. And while Palestinians have been able to acquire some 2,000 doses from Israel, 10,000 doses of the Sputnik vaccine from Russia, and another 60,000 doses delivered by the United Nations through its COVAX program, this is nowhere near enough to inoculate a population of 5 million. Even since the last year in May 2020, the United Nations asked Israel to have mercy on the hundreds of Palestinian children that it keeps in its jails and to release them for fear that they might catch COVID or spark an outbreak. Israel ignored this request and is still illegally detaining Palestinian children, just as we saw a few days ago in Hebron, continuing to brutalize them and doesn't even care to release them or inoculate them, putting their health at further risk. And in December of 2020, initially, Israel's public security minister, Amir Ohana, refused to allow Palestinian prisoners to be vaccinated in Israeli jails, and only for prison staff to be vaccinated. He even defied the orders of the health minister. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Asa Winstanley, investigative journalist and podcaster for Electronic Intifada. He writes extensively about Palestine. He's lived in Palestine. Thanks so much for taking the time, Asa. It's good to have you on.
Great to be with you, Richard. I've been a fan of your show, and you're doing really great work, so it's brilliant to be on.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So, Asa, I want to start out with the medical apartheid that's happening in occupied Palestine. You know, the Israelis are refusing to vaccinate Palestinians. What did you think of this idea that Israel wants to send vaccines to countries that will move their embassy to Jerusalem?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, Israel uses all tools that it can in the world, you know, to try and put pressure on countries to favor its international goals, you know. I mean, it uses all kinds of nefarious methods, so it's not completely surprising, but you're right. I mean, it's a typically despicable thing for them to do. And, you know, the thing that struck me as well was they started this program for vaccines for foreign diplomats living in Tel Aviv mostly, although, of course, the Americans have moved to Jerusalem now. And they're going to be vaccinating them, you know, but still there's millions of Palestinians living in territories controlled by Israel that have not been vaccinated and have no entitlement to vaccines under Israeli apartheid.
So, I mean, how is the situation looking now? Because, you know, Israel says, oh, we're number one in vaccinations, but they're not counting the Palestinians that they're occupying. And now in March, Israel says they'll start vaccinating some of the Palestinian workers that cross over. So, I mean, is that it? Is that as far as it goes?
under Israel's apartheid system, only the Jews, only the Israeli Jews have an entitlement to all sorts of different privileges, you know, and this is Israel's apartheid system. 6 million Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza Strip have no basic human or political rights under Israel's apartheid system. This is why it's called apartheid system, which, you know, there's literally different legal system for them. So this extends to the entitlement to vaccines as well. And it's only after Israel's come under massive, you know, massive amount of pressure and international criticism that they've even begun offering even a, you know, a small token amount of Palestinians, the Palestinians who work in Israeli settlements, work in what's called Israel proper, beyond the green line, supposed, offering a limited amount of them some vaccines. And it's only, you know, because of this the description of it as vaccine apartheid, it's become a very sensitive issue for them. So they've offered these few vaccines, and now they're saying, well, it's not apartheid because, you know, we're offering some Palestinians the vaccine.
So I mean, all these Israeli officials now, they're responding to this criticism by saying that it's anti-Semitic, and you know, they even got mad at this SNL joke. I mean, what is that? Isn't that obscene how they're calling out anyone who exposes their refusal to abide by the Fourth Geneva Convention as anti-Semitic?
Yeah, I mean, this is the tactic. This is Israel's tactic, isn't it? It's always Israel's tactic is to distract from its crimes by accusing its critics of having some sort of ulterior motive. You know, and the Saturday Night Live. Incident was a good example of that. You know, there was this comedian, Michael Che, I think you say his name, who made this joke of that Israel is reporting that they vaccinated half of their population, and I'm going to guess that it's the Jewish half. Well, it was a joke. It was quite a funny joke. But it was basically true, you know, because Israel was offering only, as I said, like the Jewish half of the population was really the only people who were offered the vaccine. And what illustrates that more than ever is the fact that Israeli settlers in the West Bank, even, which even under international law, which, you know, the US and everyone and Britain claims to abide by but doesn't, even under that law, those settlements in the West Bank are illegal under international law. Well, only Jews can live in them. And Israeli Jewish citizens living in those settlements, illegal settlements, were given and had right to the vaccine, but the Palestinians living in nearby communities were not. You know, so that's just a perfect example of it. And yeah, Israel's strategy is always to accuse its critics of anti-Semitism, and starting with the Palestinians.
So, I mean, Israel, they're saying that the Oslo Accords relieve them of their obligation to abide by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Do you think it's true that a bilateral agreement can just cancel out a superseding international law, which is universal, essentially?
No, of course not. I mean, even the Oslo Accords themselves, which, you know, in my view, are illegitimate anyway, but even the Oslo Accords themselves state that Israel has an obligation to provide the Palestinian Authority with support during pandemics, you know. So it doesn't relieve Israel of its obligations under international law to provide basic services. Of course, in reality, the whole goal of the Oslo Accords was to essentially subcontract out Israeli occupation to, you know, an indigenous agent, essentially. You know, like all settler colonial powers, like all instances of imperialism, Israel relies on, tries to, and in certain circumstances has been, you know, has had some measures of success to recruit native agents for its power. You know, like the British, when they occupied India, would set different religious communities against each other in order to kind of to divide and rule and to increase their power. So the Israelis know that the Palestinian Authority can keep knows its population better than they could possibly, And it's kind of a mask for them. It's kind of, it's a way for them to kind of launder their image and you know, get away from fulfilling its obligations under international law.
Yeah, and now some Arab countries as well. And, you know, I'm a bit curious because I know it's a rhetorical question, I think, but, you know, the ICC is probing Israel for war crimes, and now we have Israel violating the Geneva Convention yet again. Do you think that there are going to be any actual consequences for what Israel is doing to the Palestinians in regards to depriving them of vaccines? I know that's kind of a rhetorical question. I don't think anyone is going to actually do anything to them, but what do you think the long-term effects of this will be?
The ICC investigation is an interesting one because it's true, you know, that it's been very slow in happening. The chief prosecutor of the ICC has announced this and she's on her way out. So to clarify, she hasn't been sacked, but she's stepping down from her role, and just before she stepped down, I can't remember if it was just before or just after, but round about the same time she stepped down, she's finally, after years of talking about it and kind of prevaricating, said, okay, we are going to launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes in the Gaza Strip and West Bank. Now, it's interesting because I think the ICC... if you look at the record of the ICC, I'm not an expert on it, but I think we all know and we can all see that almost only the only people that the ICC has prosecuted so far are political leaders who are black Africans, essentially, who are accused of war crimes. And the war crimes of the West and of Israel have not been touched by it. So I think as an international body, these international bodies like the UN and the International Criminal Court and the World Court as well before it, as ostensibly international bodies, I think they do come under pressure to an extent from people in, you know, what used to be called the Third World, the Global South, and the political leaders there who are starting to notice, hang on, you're only prosecuting black Africans. What's going on here? You know, what about Britain's crimes in Iraq? What about the US crimes in Afghanistan? You know, what about the European colonial crimes? You know, if we're going back in time, you know, all over the world. And in a way, in some ways, Israel is the last... outpost of European colonialism that is still ongoing as a active settler colonial project. You know, the French were driven out of Algeria by an anti-colonial rebellion. You know, if you go back further, Haiti was the first state in the world to abolish slavery when the former enslaved Africans liberated themselves from the brutality of French slavery, and then they fought off, you know, they fought off three colonial powers: the British, the Spanish, and the French, and to become free. So, like, Israel is a settler colonial project which is still ongoing in this way, which was launched by a Western European power under the auspices of the British Empire. So I suppose in a way the ICC agreeing to prosecute that, it could be the start of something, which is why it has been viewed as dangerous by the British government and the US government, with the US government even sanctioning the chief prosecutor of the ICC, you know, at Israel's behest, at Israel's request. And that was done under the Trump administration. The same sanctions are under place, you know, even though Biden's the great white hope. Yeah, they're still in place. So these vindictive Trump sanctions are still being enforced by the Biden administration. So it depends. Let's see what happens. There are some very good Palestinian lawyers who have been working for many years now to try and use these institutions to get what they're ostensibly designed to do, right? Which is achieve justice for people who have been subjected to these crimes.
I want to remind you very briefly of Israel's recent history and how it treats healthcare workers, doctors, and what it does to Palestinian health infrastructure, right? Do you remember during 2009, during Operation Cast Lead, Israel purposely deprived Palestinians of food, of medical supplies, of essential care, and deliberately blocked and otherwise impeded emergency relief and humanitarian assistance, and purposely targeted vehicles that were carrying humanitarian relief, and violated international law. In 2014, during Israel's ground invasion of Gaza, Israel killed over 2,200 Palestinians. 65% of them were civilians. The UN found that, quote, 17 hospitals, 56 primary healthcare facilities, and 45 ambulances were damaged or destroyed. The total cost to Gaza's healthcare system, $50 million. 16 healthcare workers were killed, and 83, most of them ambulance drivers and volunteers, were injured. Then also in 2018-2019, during the Right to Return marches, Israel purposely shot at and targeted unarmed Palestinians, wounding thousands of them and killing over 180. Among them, medical staff. A report by the United Nations found that Israeli snipers intentionally shot healthcare workers despite seeing that they were clearly marked as such. One of those healthcare workers was 20-year-old Ruzan al-Najjar, who worked tirelessly as a medic to help the injured and tend to the wounded. Her death caused widespread outrage, and the Israeli occupation forces even tried to smear her after one of their own snipers deliberately killed her. Gaza itself, which has been devastated by Israel's ruthless bombings over and over, has been under siege from Israel and Egypt since 2007, with only limited humanitarian supplies being allowed through. Even construction materials are not permitted. Israel literally picks and chooses what Palestinians in Gaza can bring into their own country. A UN report from 2009 states that the Israeli blockade is one of the main reasons there is not enough medical equipment or medical supplies available. All this to say that Israel is no problem killing medical workers and medics and doctors and destroying medical and public health infrastructure belonging to Palestinians. So of course, when it suits Israel, Israel claims that Palestinians are autonomous and that they can deal with their own health issues. And yet when something doesn't suit them, like the International Criminal Court saying it will investigate them for war crimes, then all of a sudden, Israel claims that this is not possible, that Palestine is not a real state, and the ICC can't expand jurisdiction there. Sheer hypocrisy. This is what occupation looks like. This is Israel's true face, not the one that they sell you in the mainstream media about how Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. That's a fairy tale slogan. Israel is not a democracy. Israel is a racist, colonialist, settler project that was created by the United Kingdom. Israel treats Palestinians like they are less than human. Israel, since its foundation, has been ethnically cleansing the Palestinian people, bulldozing their homes, turning them into refugees, killing them in cold blood. Israel is one of the biggest human rights violators on the face of this planet and has no respect for the Geneva Convention nor for international law. Israel has purposely targeted public health infrastructure, purposely targeted medical workers, purposely targeted nurses, doctors, and paramedics, and this is documented by virtually every single news outlet and human rights organization that exists. So it's absolutely no surprise that an apartheid, genocidal regime like that would now deprive Palestinians of a vaccine even during a global pandemic on their own land and then try to whitewash its racist apartheid crimes and boast about how successful it is. This is just another chapter in Israel's long and brutal oppression of the Palestinian people, its cruel and inhumane treatment of them during war and during occupation. This depraved, wicked treatment of Palestinians will go down in history as one of the worst crimes against humanity. And people will scratch their heads. How the entire world, including many Arab nations, stood by watching and did nothing. It's an absolute disgrace, and anyone with a conscience can see that. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. It is hard to avoid the conclusion that the Joe Biden administration's fiscal irresponsibility arises from a cynical political calculation. It evidently proposes to employ the federal budget as a slush fund to distribute benefits to various political constituencies, gambling that the avalanche of new debt will not cause a financial crisis before the 2022 congressional elections. We now present you an article written by David P. Goldman, president of Macro Strategy LLC and senior writer at Law and Liberty. The piece is titled U.S. Fiscal Profligacy and the Impending Crisis. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Massive demand-side stimulus combined with the constraints on the supply side in the form of higher taxes is a sure recipe for inflation and eventual recession. According to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, the fiscal year 2021 U.S. budget deficit will amount to 15% of America's GDP, or gross domestic product, after the passage of an additional $1.9 trillion in demand stimulus, a proportion that the United States has not seen since the Second World War. It is hard to avoid the conclusion that the Biden administration's fiscal irresponsibility arises from a cynical political calculation. It evidently proposes to employ the federal budget as a slush fund to distribute benefits to various political constituencies, gambling that the avalanche of new debt will not cause a financial crisis before the 2022 congressional elections. The additional $2.3 trillion in so-called infrastructure spending that the Biden administration has proposed consists mainly of handouts to Democratic constituencies. During the 12 months ending in March, the deficit stood at 19% of gross domestic product, or GDP. Even worse, the Federal Reserve absorbed virtually all the increase in outstanding debt on its balance sheet. In the aftermath of the 2009 recession, when the deficit briefly rose to 10% of the gross domestic product GDP, foreigners bought about half of the total new issuance of Treasury debt. During the past 12 months, foreigners have been net sellers of U.S. government debt. The U.S. dollar's role as the world's principal reserve currency is eroding fast, and fiscal irresponsibility of this order threatens to accelerate the dollar's decline. The U.S. Federal Reserve has kept short-term interest rates low by monetizing debt, but long-term Treasury yields have risen by more than a percentage point since last July. Markets know that what can't go on forever won't. At some point, private holders of U.S. Treasury debt will liquidate their holdings, as foreigners have begun to do, and rates will rise sharply. For every percentage point increase in the cost of financing federal debt, the U.S. Treasury will have to pay an additional $250 billion in interest. The United States well may find itself in the position of Italy in 2018, but without the rich members of the European Union to bail it out. The flood of federal spending has had a number of dangerous effects already. The U.S. trade deficit in goods as of February 2021 reached an annualized rate of more than $1 trillion a year, an all-time record. China's exports to the United States over the past 12 months, ending in February, also reached an all-time record. Federal stimulus created demand that the U.S. productive facilities could not meet and produced a massive import boom. According to Philadelphia Federal Reserve survey, input prices to U.S. manufacturers in February rose at the fastest rate since 1973, and the gap between input prices and finished goods prices rose at the fastest rate since 2009. The Producer Price Index, PPI, for final demand rose at an annualized 11% rate during the first quarter of this year. The Consumer Price Index, CPI, shows year-on-year growth of only 1.7%, but that reflects dodgy measurements. For example, the price shelter, which comprises a third of the index, supposedly rose just 1.5% over the year, although home prices rose by as much as 10%. If foreigners are net sellers of U.S. Treasury securities, how is the United States financing an external deficit in the range of $1 trillion a year? The United States has two deficits to finance, the internal budget deficit and the balance of payment deficit, and here we refer to this second deficit. The answer is, according to the Treasury data, by selling stocks to foreigners. According to the Treasury International Capital, or TIC system, foreign investors have been dumping low-yielding U.S. Treasuries and corporate bonds during the past year. Foreign investors bought $400 billion of U.S. equities and nearly $500 billion of U.S. agency securities backed by home mortgages during the 12 months through to January, but sold $600 billion of treasuries and $100 billion of corporate bonds. This is a bubble on top of a bubble. The U.S. Federal Reserve buys $4 trillion of treasury securities and pushes the after-inflation yield below zero. That pushes investors into stocks. Foreigners don't want U.S. treasuries at negative real yields, but they buy into the stock market, which keeps rising, because the U.S. Federal Reserve is pushing down bond yields and so forth. Today, however, the U.S. Treasury market is the weak link in the financial system, supported only by the central bank's monetization of debt. If the extreme fiscal profligacy of the Biden administration prompts private investors to exit the Treasury market, there will be no safe assets left in dollar financial markets. The knock-on effects would be extremely hard to control. The overwhelming majority of the over-the-counter privately traded derivatives contracts serve as interest rate hedges. Market participants typically pledge Treasury securities as collateral for those contracts. According to the Bank for International Settlements, the notional value of such contracts now exceeds $600 trillion. Derivative contracts entail a certain amount of market risk, and banks will enter into them with customers who want to hedge interest rate positions only if the customers put up collateral, like the cash margin on a stock bought on credit. The market value, after netting for matching contracts that cancel each other out, is about $15 trillion. If the prices of Treasury securities fall sharply, the result will be a global margin call in the derivatives market, forcing the liquidation of vast amounts of positions. Something like this occurred between 6th of March and 18th of March 2020, when the yield on inflation-protected U.S. Treasury securities, or TIPS, jumped from about negative 0.6% to positive 0.6% in just 2 weeks. The COVID-19 crash prompted a run on cash at American banks, as U.S. corporate borrowers drew down their credit lines. U.S. banks, in turn, cut credit lines to European and Japanese banks, who were forced to withdraw funding to their customers for currency hedges on holdings of U.S. Treasury securities. The customers, in turn, liquidated U.S. Treasury securities, and the Treasury market crashed. That was the first time that a Treasury market crash coincided with a stock market crash. Instead of acting as a crisis refuge, the U.S. Treasury market became the epicenter of the crisis itself. The U.S. Federal Reserve quickly stabilized the market through massive purchases of Treasury securities and through the extension of dollar swap lines to European central banks, which in turn restored dollar liquidity to their customers. The emergency actions were justified by the extraordinary circumstances of March of 2020. An external shock, namely the COVID-19 pandemic, upended financial markets, and the central bank acted responsibly in extending liquidity to the market. But the U.S. Federal Reserve and the Biden administration now propose to extend these emergency measures into a continuing flood of demand. The consequences will be dire. The present situation is unprecedented in another way as well. Not in the past century has the United States faced a competitor with an economy as big as ours, growing much faster than ours, in fact, with ambitions to displace us as the world's leading economic power. China believes that America's fiscal irresponsibility will undermine the dollar status as the world's reserve currency.
People of Palestine have long suffered aggression at the hands of Israel, but that escalated to epic proportions in this Ramadan. The regime launched a crackdown on Palestinian worshippers and restricted their gatherings in the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds during the Muslim Holy Month. Later in the month, an Israeli court ruled that over a dozen Palestinian families must leave their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem al-Quds immediately, despite having lived there for generations. The eviction order sparked several protests in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The crackdown on ensued injured hundreds of Palestinians. It also drew condemnations from the international community against Israel, with even the Arab countries that have recently normalized ties with the regime, namely Sudan, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, denouncing the Israeli forces' storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
It's not only the general oppression of Israel, but Israel got very aggressive with the district of Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah, where they want to get rid of all the remaining Palestinian families. The Israelis, I think, did not anticipate what they were stepping into when they chose to evict all of these families at the same time in the month of Ramadan.
The United Nations Human Rights Office urged Israel to cease the eviction order immediately. It said, the transfer of parts of an occupying power's civilian population into the territory that it occupies is prohibited under international humanitarian law and may amount to a war crime. Israel has been trying to downplay the recent clashes, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu strongly rejecting international pressure not to build settlements in Jerusalem al-Quds.
We also firmly reject the pressures not to build in Jerusalem. To my regret, these pressures have been increasing of late. I say also to the best of our friends, Jerusalem is Israel's capital, and just as every nation builds in its capital and builds up its capital, we also have the right to build in Jerusalem and to build up Jerusalem. That is what we have done, and that is what we will continue to do.
But under international law, all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal. The United Nations Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement building activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Jerusalem al-Quds remains at heart of a decades-long conflict, with Palestinians insisting that East al-Quds, illegally occupied by Israel since 1967, must serve as the capital of a Palestinian state. In the meantime, the Al-Aqsa Mosque has had enormous significance throughout the years. In the year 2000, an Israeli official's visit to the holy site provoked a Palestinian uprising known as the Second Intifada. Observers say the recent escalation of violence surrounding the Al-Aqsa Mosque could be a prelude to a third intifada.
As far as I'm concerned, an intifada is always possible in Palestine. The Israelis are putting more and more pressure. They're hoping to keep the pressure at just the right level to cause, to motivate the ethnic cleansing, the expulsion of the Palestinians, the marginalization of the Palestinians, without having it explode completely.
Emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's all-out support, Israel has stepped up its aggression against the Palestinian people. But with Trump gone, for how long can it keep on committing its crimes?
The coronavirus pandemic has struck a heavy blow against major economies across the globe. Many people have lost their jobs or seen their income cut. However, development of vaccines was a breakthrough. Countries across the globe launched vaccination programs in order to reverse this negative trend and help their economies recover. Yet things have not worked out well for the world's largest economy, the U.S. According to the latest monthly employment report by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. economy gained only 266,000 jobs last month. That is while economists had expected the number to top 1 million. Also, the unemployment rate rose to 6.1% amid an increasing shortage of available workers. But there were more bad news, as March's originally estimated 916,000 job gains were revised down to 770,000. Vaccination efforts and the relaxing of lockdown measures across the U.S. were expected to result in steady job growth. Yet the disappointing report is a surprise setback for U.S. President Joe Biden's efforts to revive America's economy from the coronavirus pandemic conundrum.
We came to office. We knew we were facing a once-in-a-century pandemic and a once-in-a-generation economic crisis. And we knew this wouldn't be a sprint. It'd be a marathon.
The April data shows the U.S. economy still has 8.2 million fewer jobs than it had in February of 2020, before the pandemic hit.
We're still digging out of an economic collapse that cost us 22 million jobs. Let me say that again. It cost us 22 million jobs. When we came in, we inherited a year of profound economic crisis and mismanagement on the virus.
Biden claims his $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package is helping the U.S. economy to recover and is also pushing for another $4 trillion to be spent on infrastructure, education, and other priorities. However, his critics object to the high price tag and are warning that that could bring inflation. Moreover, Republicans and business groups have raised concerns about a disincentive for people to return to their jobs.
The reality was 75% less than what they had predicted. So it's a huge shortfall. I believe the economy is much weaker. I believe all the talk about a super powerful recovery was overdone. I think the economy is really struggling with the after effects of the pandemic. It's listless, it's weak, there are huge financial problems.
The U.S. Labor Department's monthly report fell significantly short of expectations. While economists predicted that the economy would add about 1 million jobs, the report was a huge disappointment. Economists attribute the disappointing results to a range of issues, including safety concerns, child care issues, as well as extended unemployment benefits. In addition, according to government surveys, the number of unemployed workers is way higher than job openings. Also, there have not been any meaningful wage increases either, which are a hallmark of labor shortage.
There's a lot of speculation as to why. The Republicans, the conservatives blame it on over-generous unemployment benefits. I'm very skeptical. I think those jobs do not pay very well. I think if wages were higher, workers would be quicker to sign on. But as things stand now, the wages are so low that it may be more worth their while to stay at home and take care of the kids.
Unemployment rates for Black and Latino women remained high. That is while women are being employed at lower rates in the U.S. Meanwhile, the hard-hit hospitality sector, which includes restaurants and hotels, and also manufacturing sectors, are unable to fill the job openings. That is while the unemployment rate is at high levels. Many unemployed Americans are reluctant to look for jobs because they fear catching the coronavirus. Others have entered new occupations and have left their old jobs. Moreover, many women, working mothers in particular, have left the workforce to care for children. Republicans and critics blame the Biden administration's policies for the slow economic recovery.
Well, that's what the Republicans complain. They want to see unemployment benefits cut because they want to force workers to go back to work. But it's very hard to tell. The wages have fallen very low, and workers have a lot of responsibilities at home.
The latest report reveals that the U.S. economy still has a long way to go to recover from the coronavirus pandemic.
The remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal have been meeting in the Austrian capital, Vienna, in recent weeks to find a way to salvage the international accord. While few details about the talks have been revealed, Press TV has learned that the U.S. and the European signatories to the deal apparently want the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges in return for a temporary suspension of some of the sanctions related to the nuclear deal, officially titled the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. This is while, under the JCPOA, Iran's advanced centrifuges, including IR-4, IR-6, and IR-9s, must be stored away under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency and not destroyed. Press TV obtained information that shows Iran won't give in to the excessive demands of the Westerners, and also in case of insistence on the part of the other side, the possibility of the JCPOA, and not just the negotiations in Vienna, unraveling altogether will be real.
The Iranians have seen what the Americans and the Europeans have done. They've talked and talked and talked a lot about how they want the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action to succeed, and yet they've done everything in their power to ensure that it won't succeed. The Europeans refuse to permit to trade with Iran in any kind of barter arrangement, even with that INSTEX, that International Exchange Program, So they're simply kowtowing to the Americans, acting as their running dogs, and simply making a big production out of nothing. It's a simple matter to abolish the sanctions and rejoin the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But of course they won't do that, and they want to blame the Iranians for their own failures.
The new demands, meant to impose new nuclear commitments on Iran, have been put forward while the U.S. has not even agreed to remove all the JCPOA-related sanctions, a condition set by Tehran for a possible U.S. return to the nuclear deal. U.S. President Joe Biden has expressed his willingness to reverse Trump's policy regarding the JCPOA and to rejoin the deal. However, his administration has so far refused to take any meaningful action to gain Iran's trust and come back to compliance. External influences may have been a contributing factor. The U.S. president has reportedly met with the head of the Israeli regime's intelligence service, Mossad, in Washington, D.C. last week and told him his country isn't close to returning to the Iran nuclear deal. Biden reportedly said the United States has a long way to go in talks with Iran before it agrees to return to full compliance, comments that appear to have been assurances to Israel, which is a vehement opponent of the deal. The Mossad chief also reportedly asked Biden not to rejoin the accord without improving it first.
Well, Yossi Cohen, meeting with Jack Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor, in Washington, with Biden just happening, mind you, happening to drop by the talks, is a clear indication that it's outside pressure and it's aimed at making inside demands and inside controls on the American government. By the Israelis to reject and ditch the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The Israelis are probably afraid that someone might ask questions about why the JCPOA applies only to Iran and why isn't there not one that applies to Israel, India, and Pakistan, other nuclear states, with a very unstable track record. So I think that it is pressure from the inside, pressure under the table, if not subterranean.
Iran says the ball is in the U.S.'s court to return to the agreement and remove all its sanctions on Tehran, or pursue the failed policy of its predecessor, known as Maximum Pressure Campaign, and push ahead with its hostile policy against the Islamic Republic.
Israel's occupation of Palestine and the plight of Palestinians have once again come into focus globally as people worldwide mark the International Quds Day. Every year, on the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan, pro-Palestinian groups from all faiths show solidarity with those affected by the occupation. The issue of Palestine is today recognized as one of the most complicated crises that seems far from any kind of resolution. But when did it all begin? The mass displacement of Palestinians from their ancestral lands mainly dates back to May 14, 1948, when Israel was created in Palestine and immediately recognized by the United States. Palestine had been under British colonial control until May that year. Britain had long encouraged Zionist Jews to come to Palestine. The 1948 Declaration of Independence is widely considered as the starting point for an occupation that has triggered many wars and impacted the whole Middle East and the world. Soon after the creation of Israel, the forced displacement of Palestinians, known as the Nakba, or catastrophe, began. Several hundred Palestinian villages were razed to the ground, and their residents were forced to flee and were never allowed to return. Today, the refugees and their descendants around the world number 5 million. Israel has been seizing more Palestinian lands over the past decades and keeps building on them. What's now left for the Palestinians is a tiny fraction of their original homeland. This map shows how Palestinian territories have been shrinking over the past decades. Israeli violations of Palestinians' rights are many. To Israeli authorities, Palestinian lives don't matter at all. The Israeli regime does not hesitate to kill. Meanwhile, the regime has engaged in demographic engineering, discrimination in access to education, health care, and building rights. Just days ago, leading international rights group Human Rights Watch issued a report condemning Israel for committing the crimes of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories. In 2017, the UN Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia issued a damning report on Israeli practices in occupied Palestinian territories. The report said Israel has established an apartheid regime that oppresses the Palestinians as a whole. But for Israel, such reports and repeated UN resolutions are no big concern, as the regime has full U.S. diplomatic cover. Meanwhile, Palestinians have been let down by some Arab states. Last year, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan recognized Israel and normalized their ties with the regime. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinians know all too well that their options are very limited at the moment. As many governments refuse to pressure the Israeli regime, it is hoped that resistance and popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day change things for the better.
Raising awareness, circulating these things on social media, holding your politicians accountable, also bring the campaign aid, help people in Palestine. You know, everybody can reach out to somebody in Palestine and let them videotape the scenario around them. Like, you know, Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, we always have campaign aids in Gaza. And, you know, when they get us video coverage of the houses inside and how they're living in their neighborhoods, this already by itself shows how this blockade and this occupation has treated these people and what status they're at right now. They're living in poverty. They're living in the worst conditions. And this is because of the occupation, nothing else.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
California has expanded a drought emergency declaration to a large swathe of the nation's most populated state amid acute water supply shortages in northern and central parts of California. The declaration expanded by California Governor Gavin Newsom on Monday, 10th of May, now includes 41 of 58 counties, covering 30% of California's nearly 40 million people. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Associated Press. The piece is titled, California Declares Drought Emergency Across Vast Swathe of State. California has expanded a drought emergency declaration to a large swathe of the nation's most populated state amid acute water supply shortages in northern and central parts of California. The declaration, expanded by California Governor Gavin Newsom on Monday, 10th of May, now includes 41 of 58 counties, covering 30% of California's nearly 40 million.